Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Early afternoon on Friday, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced the death knell for the American Health Care Act, the proposal put forward by majority Republicans and backed by the president to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Ryan spoke privately with President Trump at the White House and then threw in the towel publicly at a press conference. But he stood by the GOP plan.
I'm really proud of the bill that we produced. It would make a dramatic improvement in our health care system and provide relief by people hurting under Obamacare. And what's probably most troubling is the worst is yet to come with Obamacare.
We're talking about what's to come with health insurance in the United States today in the wake of the recent failure in Congress. Joining us now is a health care reporter for Politico, Paul Demko. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Republican leadership was promising a three-pronged approach to changing health care coverage. You reported, of course, that the first prong was the failed repeal and replace bill. What about the other prongs?
Well, presumably they're going to try to move forward with some of them. I mean, the second is already underway, and that is Health and Human Services Commissioner Tom Price doing what he can through administrative action, through regulations to make changes and hopefully improvements to the bill. So you've already seen some proposed changes there that should be finalized shortly. And I think they'll probably redouble those efforts and try to do as much as they can on that front, given how much trouble they've run into doing anything legislatively. And then that third prong is more problematic because that's kind of additional pieces of legislation that they've promised to pass. But the problem you run into there is anything that they want to actually enact is going to require 60 votes in the Senate. So you're going to have some kind of bipartisan buy-in. And right now it's tough to see how we get there.
When you talk about what Secretary Price is doing to make changes to the bill, are you talking about the Republican bill that failed last week, or are you talking about the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say one of the big complaints that insurers have had is that there's these special enrollment periods where people can sign up for coverage sort of outside the standard enrollment window. And there's been a concern that people have been sort of gaming the system and waiting until they get sick and need coverage before signing up. And so one of the things that the Trump administration is doing, and I think, you know, the Obama administration had been doing too, is tightening the rules around these special enrollments to try to make the system a little tighter and make it a little more difficult for people to kind of flout what the accepted practices.
I'm trying to figure out, is the Trump administration with House Republicans, House and Senate Republicans, going to work to make Obamacare better, or are they going to sit back and watch it explode, as the president has referred to it in his tweets, and let it fall to pieces?
It's really, really confusing. They're really sending mixed signals, and I don't know if they know. I mean, on the one hand, you had them canceling up to $5 million in advertisements that were set to go out in the final days of open enrollment, which is a crucial period, especially for attracting some of the younger, healthier folks that the exchange markets really need. On the other hand, as I mentioned, you know, they've put out this regulation designed to sort of stabilize the marketplaces. So there's just a lot of uncertainty and mixed signals about where they want to go. And that's kind of what we're looking for right now. Now that this repeal bill, the American Health Care Act, has collapsed, we really need some guidance from the administration about what they intend to do, because time is running short. You got to remember that for the 2018 open enrollment period, insurers are already kind of putting together their policies and premiums and making decisions about participation. So they need some kind of reinsurance about what these markets are going to look like. Or you really could see them kind of flee and see kind of the collapse that Trump keeps referencing. But that doesn't have to happen.
We're talking this hour about what's next in healthcare coverage in the United States now that the proposed repeal and replace effort by Republicans has failed in the House. My guest is Paul Demko. He's healthcare reporter for Politico. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Some have said that the Republicans will now sabotage the Affordable Care Act. The president has alluded to it falling apart on its own volition. What do you think is more likely at this point, that they'll actively sabotage or that it'll just won't get the tweaks and the oil changes it needs to keep going?
Yeah, well, I think the latter. I don't know. I mean, Trump seems to believe, I mean, at least he professes this, whether he believes it or not, that, you know, somehow Democrats will be saddled with the blame politically if these things collapse. But I don't think many other people think that's the case. I mean, Republicans are in control of the entire government. They've been in control for the entire government for more than 2 months now. The marketplaces are struggling. They aren't stable. But most economists, most healthcare economists, most financial analysts don't think they're going to collapse, particularly because most people who are in the marketplaces get subsidies. And so even if premiums are going up, even if they don't have as many choices as they would like, they're not paying a ton of money out of pocket for this cost. For their coverage, I mean, and so they're going to be highly motivated to stay. And as long as there's sort of a baseline of, you know, around 10 million folks or so who are in the marketplaces, most people think they'll kind of plod along. But there's a big moment coming up. I don't want to get too technical here, but there's something called cost sharing subsidies that the poorest exchange customers get to help them cover out of pocket costs. And the Obama administration had appropriated money for that, or had put forth money for that. And the House sued contesting, saying they didn't have the authority to do that. And so there's this lawsuit out there pending right now. And we need to figure out what, if the House is going to continue with that, what the Trump administration's stance is. And we need to find those things out quickly, because insurers are really counting on that money. And it will impact whether they decide to stay in these marketplaces for 2018.
Is this the lawsuit you said the House brought, but isn't it a lawsuit brought by insurers?
No, that's a slightly different thing.
Okay.
That's the risk corridor program. I know I'm getting way in the weeds there.
Well,
and insurers are suing over that. They've been shortchanged about $8 billion or so that they were counting on. And there's a number of lawsuits pending on that issue as well. And the courts have kind of split on whether they're actually entitled to that money. So we need resolution for that, too. But that's kind of beyond the hands of, I guess Congress could take steps to appropriate that money, too. But right now, that's probably going to be decided by the courts in the coming months.
Paul Ryan has characterized the American Health Care Act, now failed, as a favor to Democrats. It would have taken the onus off of Democrats for responsibility the coverage. Trump also tweeted, "The Democrats will make a deal with me on health care as soon as Obamacare folds. Not long. Do not worry. We are in very good shape," he tweeted. Are Democrats likely to collaborate with the president or Republicans on health care at this point?
In the short term, I think that's highly unlikely. I think if you watched on Friday, they were fairly gleeful at watching this train wreck occur, you know, especially after just being lambasted by Republicans for 7 years and paying a very heavy political price for passing the Affordable Care Act and for it not, you know, living up to all of the expectations and maybe some of the promises as well. So I think right now they're kind of sitting back and watching Republicans kind of stew in their own mess as they come to the realization that, as the president noted, healthcare is extremely complicated and extremely messy. Now, do we get to a point at somewhere down the road where there could be bipartisan collaboration? I think that's, you know, it's possible, but it's tough to see the path there right at this moment. I think there's just too much partisanship and lingering animosity to get there right now.
I'm going to be talking to a representative of the Heritage Foundation later on in the program, but one of the things they've put forth is just to repeal. The Republicans, as everybody knows, many times voted and successfully voted to repeal, or had said they had the votes to repeal, but they wanted to replace as well. What were they worried about? Why not just go ahead and repeal? Because a lot of people have been asking me that listen.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people, you know, on the conservative end of their caucus that would like to, you know, that will say, look, this was good enough in 2015 when we passed it. Mm-hmm. Why isn't it good enough now? The problem is, you know, what comes next? And you would essentially be making a bet that you could, because you would need 60 votes for whatever comes next. So you would need bipartisan engagement. And I think the fear among a lot of Republicans is that you would scrap everything, you would scrap all these coverage programs that 20 million or so people have gotten coverage through, and then you would, you know, try to begin to implement your preferred system. And if you couldn't get anywhere, if you couldn't get bipartisan support, which seems unlikely, then you would be left with nothing. And I think the fear is that there would be a great deal of political fallout from that and that Republicans would pay a price. They've tried to kind of thread the needle, and it's just incredibly difficult to do, because anything you do with the healthcare system, there's going to be winners and losers, and it's not going to be perfect.
What about the Freedom Caucus? The president has taunted them in a tweet about Obamacare and Planned Parenthood. What are their options at this point? Where? I mean, obviously they wield power, but how much?
Yeah, I mean, they have the ability to pretty much block anything they want if they hang together, as they pretty much did in this instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, there was lots of moderate opposition that was growing to this bill too, so it wasn't just the Freedom Caucus. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the problem with their stance, is they have operated, and Paul Ryan said this, I mean, they have operated as a minority party, as a resistance party, and that's the, you know, nobody really knows what the Freedom Caucus is for. You know, that's the challenge. I guess they're for, you know, a straight repeal. Mm-hmm. It's tough to understand exactly what would placate them. As this debate went on last week, it was very messy, and a lot of it was behind closed doors, but it seemed like, you know, the Trump administration and House leadership made a huge concession to the conservatives by repealing the essential health benefits, by agreeing to repeal the essential health benefits, the 10 kind of required coverage benefits that every ACA plan must have. And yet that still wasn't good enough for them. So it's tough to know what would assuage the Freedom Caucus folks.
I'm going to put a caller on with you, Paul Demko, who's want to ask kind of a basic question, but maybe you can explain what the thoughts are among the opinion leaders in Washington. David in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. So Medicare is a very good system. I'm on it now. It has very, very, very low overhead, 10% of the insurance industry overhead. Why don't we have Medicare for all people living in the United States? The only downside I see is that the hundreds of thousands of insurance workers will have to be retrained, but no problem with that. Hmm. Thank you much.
All right, Paul Demko, that must have been raised at some point in this philosophical discussion in Washington.
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely been a stance of certainly people on the left. And I think the problem you encounter with that is, you know, when Democrats had total control of the government way back in 2009, you couldn't get agreement on something along those lines. You couldn't even get agreement on a public option to kind of provide competition with the insurance companies. So now that we have, you know, total GOP control in Washington, it's really tough to see how we get there. And the other problem with that is, even though Americans know that there are lots of problems with our healthcare system and lots of problems with insurance coverage, most folks are pretty happy with the coverage they have through their job. So anytime you decide to kind of take people out of their coverage, you remember the uproar over canceled plans in mm-hmm. 2013, you're going to have a huge outcry from people. So even though, like, theoretically, I think a lot of people would think Medicare for all is a good idea, if you tell them, okay, we're going to start by taking away this coverage that you and your family rely on and really like and are happy with, it's going to cause huge problems. But the discussion is still out there. I mean, Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, put in a Medicare for All bill just on Monday in the wake of this failure of the American Health Care Act. So the discussion is still going on.
Paul Dumko, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
That's Paul Dumko. He's a healthcare reporter for Politico. Coming up, we're going to hear from different sides of the coins on this issue. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, Republicans threw in the towel on their plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, failing to muster the necessary votes in the GOP-controlled House. The holdouts included some moderate Republicans, but next to Democrats, of course, the three dozen members of the conservative Republican Freedom Caucus mounted the strongest opposition to the American Health Care Act. So, what's next? We invited Ohio GOP Congressman Jim Jordan, a co-founder of the Freedom Caucus, to join us today. His office did not respond to our request. Joining us now is the executive director of the Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio, Steve Wagner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us by phone is healthcare expert and emeritus professor at the Washington and Lee University School of Law, Timothy Jost. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We have heard dire predictions about the health of the Affordable Care Act, that its individual market is collapsing primarily. You say that isn't an accurate characterization. How do you summarize the overall health of the ACA?
This is Tim.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Coming into the Trump administration, it was in reasonably good shape, and the Congressional Budget Office report on the American Health Care Act recognized that the market was stabilizing in most states, and that's been confirmed by independent reports and by earlier work by HHS as well. So I think the question is, at this point, is the Trump administration going to take efforts to further stabilize the market, or are they going to, as President Trump has threatened, drive it over the cliff? And the market is pretty delicate right now. Insurers are at this very moment deciding whether they're going to come back for 2018 or not. And the Trump administration has sent some signals that it's not sure whether it wants them to, whether it wants to continue to support the market or not. I think it's been sending signals in both directions. So I think it has to take some pretty dramatic action to send the message that it continues to believe we need an individual insurance market in this country. And I think it's important to realize we're not just talking about the Affordable Care Act marketplace. We're talking about the entire individual insurance market. And there are many people in Ohio and elsewhere, farmers, ranchers, self-employed people who depend on the individual insurance market, and who would be left high and dry if the administration really does decide to drive it over the cliff.
Why is that the case? Why is letting it, you know, fall over the cliff affecting people who aren't getting their insurance through the ACA?
Because the entire individual market is one risk pool. Insurers, when they set their premiums, have to consider both the 12 million people that are getting coverage through the marketplace and probably 8 to 10 million people who are getting insurance outside the marketplace as a single risk pool. And if they decided to leave the marketplace, if they decided to that the marketplace wasn't stabilizing and they had to either leave the market or dramatically increase their premiums, most insurers would probably leave the entire market because they would be concerned that if they just stayed in for the people who were willing to buy coverage off the marketplace and pay high premiums, they would get a very sick population that they really couldn't cover.
Steve Wagner, where do you see the weak links in the Affordable Care Act? Do you agree with Tim Jost that it starts with the pool?
Yeah, I think we're worried. We saw the number of insurers that were in each county decline last year. I think that if the Trump administration is not supportive of the markets, that we could see some problems in contraction of the number of insurers that are there. And so that, you know, that takes away the options that people have in terms of getting coverage that they need.
Tim Jost, the whole idea of options, that was a big thing back when the legislation was passed, you know, 7+ years ago when it went into effect. That's been a big complaint about the program, that people don't have the choices that they want. Was that ever a realistic promise?
Yeah, I mean, early on, there were quite a few insurers who signed up. Now, more in some counties than in others, more in some states than in others. Mm-hmm. There were some. There have been some real problems with. I mean, one of the biggest problems was that one of the initiatives of the Affordable Care Act was to create some consumer co-ops that would offer coverage in states where there wasn't much competition, and the individual market has always been there have always been fairly few competitors in most states.
Mm-hmm.
But that program was defunded by the Republicans, and then the Republicans in Congress defunded what are called the risk corridor program payments that were supposed to support insurers through the first 3 years as they were sort of getting their legs. And most of the co-ops folded. And the risk corridor payments also, quite a number of the commercial insurers were shorted on those. So I think that the insurers have been concluding that this is not a great market to make a profit in. And quite a few of them have left and more are considering leaving. The other thing to remember, though, is that most people who get insurance through their jobs don't have a lot of choice of insurers, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, many employers offer only one or a couple of insurers. So the choices that people have in the individual market are often still greater than those that are available for many employees.
You wrote about some technical issues at stake in insurer lawsuits over commitments made by Congress to insurers, insurers that participate in the ACA. What's happening with that?
Well, there are several lawsuits going on right now. There are about 23 lawsuits going on brought by insurers raising this issue of the risk corridors, which I just mentioned,
right,
which is a very technical issue. But basically, the government was supposed to, under the ACA, help share the risk for insurers who lost money in the individual market for the first 3 years. And Congress limited those payments, and they're now about $8 billion short. And courts have ruled both ways on those cases, and it'll have to be resolved through the appellate courts. The other big lawsuit is a lawsuit that the House filed, House of the Representatives, filed against President Obama and the Obama administration, HHS, claiming that the cost-sharing reduction payments that are owed to insurers were not covered by an appropriation and were thus illegal. And these are very important payments. The insurers are required to reduce cost-sharing for low-income people, that is, deductibles, co-insurance, out-of-pocket limits. The law says that the government is supposed to reimburse insurers for doing that. But the Republicans in Congress have argued there's no appropriation for that. And that's about $9 billion. And if that lawsuit succeeds, it did succeed at the district court level, but the decision there is on hold pending an appeal. But if those payments were cut off, insurers would, I think that would really be the death knell for the individual market. Insurers would certainly not come back for 2018, and some of them would try to pull out for 2017.
So was there an appropriation or not? I mean,
the Obama administration argued that there was, that the appropriation was part of the appropriation for the premium tax credits. And if you read the statute over and over and over again, it links the two together. It talks about them in the same clause or sentence. So I think that's what Congress intended. But the lower court ruled otherwise, and that's the issue that is now before the D.C. Court of Appeals and has been stayed more or less indefinitely. I think that the Trump administration and Congress are trying to figure out what to do next. And actually, I just saw a couple of minutes ago a statement from the head of one of the appropriations committees that Congress would probably do something about that.
Steve Wagner, Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio has been involved in the rollout and supported Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, since the very, very beginning. Where have you seen things unravel in Ohio?
Well, you know, some of it's about how it's supported. So we have many people who advocate for people to participate in the marketplace, but we have a Department of Insurance that does very little to publicize the fact that there is such thing as marketplace plans.
The State Department of Insurance.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So there is that piece that where you had the Obama administration was very active in promoting enrollment. We did not have a comparable state kind of cheerleader for people to get insurance. That's one place. And I think it's that ability to encourage insurers to participate in our marketplace here.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what next for health care coverage in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, I got a question. So I've been in the individual market for about 5 years, and I'm also a small business owner trying to provide health care for my employees. I guess I see the two biggest issues is one is the lack of transparency in these provider insurance company networks. To me, what would make more sense is to, you know, get rid of that system and say, well, hey, providers can only charge one price. It doesn't matter what insurance, you know, plan you have and what network you're in. You know, there's one price. Insurance is going to pay one price. It doesn't matter, you know, what provider you go to. There's a fixed price. And to me, that would provide a lot of price transparency to shop around and potentially bring the price down. The other thing is in terms of the pools, you know, I provide healthcare reimbursements now that the SBHRA was introduced that allows me to finally provide premium support to my employees. And I think what would make sense for these pools is to, right now you have a business pool, if you have a job and your company provides it and you have an individual market. To me, what would make more sense, again, is to have a single pool where all the insurance is associated with an individual's. Companies can provide reimbursements or the government if you don't have a job, but there's one pool then, and we don't have these two separate pools with two different risk categories. And I'd like to hear what you think about that.
Tim Jost?
Well, those are very interesting proposals. Obviously, they would pretty radically change our healthcare system. The issue of uniform pricing for all providers, it's essentially price regulation, and I think it would be vigorously resisted by most healthcare providers. There is huge variation in prices among providers, and in the United States, as I think probably everybody who's listening knows, we spend far more on healthcare than any other country. And the biggest reason for that is not because we use more care. In fact, we have fewer days of hospitalization and fewer physician visits than many other countries, but our prices are so much higher. And, of course, one person's price is another person's profit and income. So any kind of control over prices means we're controlling incomes for some pretty politically powerful people, so that would be a very hard change to make. In terms of getting everybody into one market, into the individual market, that has been the vision of particularly some conservative commentators on health policy. There have been some sort of weak efforts towards trying to limit the generosity of employer coverage in the Cadillac plan tax, which just keeps getting put off over and over again, and then some provisions in a leaked draft of Republican plan that were dropped when the final plan came out. But, again, employer coverage is tremendously popular in the United States. And any effort to try to the Clintons in the early 1990s tried to restructure employer coverage and were slapped down really hard. And when the Affordable Care Act came out, they pretty much left employer coverage alone. And the Republicans decided to do the same thing. It insures most Americans. It's very popular. And nobody wants to try to mess with it. So, but the problem then is that the individual market is always kind of a poor stepchild. And so I think you've really put your finger on an important problem.
Steve Wagner?
Yeah, I think the other piece about a uniform pricing. So, yeah, you can either catch up the slack with basically cutting into the profits, but the reason that you think about it that way is that we have essential health benefits. We have the kind of the requirements these on what all plans should cover, and that in a sense fixes a lot of the costs in place. And I think those pieces, the essential health benefits and the free preventive health services that are part of the ACA, are something that a lot of people thought was extremely important in terms of the care that they were offered and what it was to have healthcare coverage. So that makes it really challenging to think about changing to a uniform price when you have to cover all of those essential health benefits.
Steve Wagner, I have to say goodbye to you. I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Steve Wagner, Executive Director of the Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio. Tim Jost, healthcare expert, will stay with us, and we'll be hearing from the Heritage Foundation coming up. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future of healthcare coverage in the United States now that the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act has been shelved, at least for now. Still with us by phone is healthcare expert and emeritus professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law, Timothy Jost. Joining us now is the Director of Policy Services at the Heritage Foundation, Rachel Bovard. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
The president a few days ago tweeted, Democrats are smiling in D.C. That the Freedom Caucus, with the help of Club for Growth and Heritage, have saved Planned Parenthood and, pardon me, OCARE. I guess it's another word for Obamacare. Rachel, what about, I imagine you don't see the failed American Health Care Act as a road to the saving Planned Parenthood. Do you agree with the president grouping the Heritage Foundation with the Freedom Caucus and the Club for Growth on this score?
Well, look, I think the president is frustrated, you know, understandably so. He wanted, this is a big campaign promise for him, and he wanted to fulfill it. And the kind of attempt wasn't one that could get across the finish line. You know, I don't think his tweet accurately reflects the broad opposition that existed to the bill. I mean, sure, the Freedom Caucus opposed it. You know, at Heritage, we didn't fully support the policies. We wanted to see more done in the bill. But you had a bunch of moderates that also didn't support the bill. The Tuesday group, which is a group of House moderates, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee wouldn't even support the bill. So this is a bill that just didn't reach consensus in the House. And that's the, you know, has happened before. This is the messy process of legislating. And it sounds like, based on reports that they have putting out this morning, that they're going back to the drawing board, that they're not quite done with healthcare reform, despite the comments that were made on Friday by Speaker Ryan and the president. House members have just broken out of a meeting on Capitol Hill where it sounds like they're going to try to move forward again.
Well, you've said that the Republicans' agenda hinges on passage of Obamacare repeal and hope hopefully, well, you didn't say this, but in a lot of people's minds, some kind of replacement. So it makes sense that they would go back to the drawing board at this point. Why does the Republican agenda hinge on a repeal of Obamacare?
Well, I think this is the big promise that they made on the campaign trails. This is the promise they've been making for 7 years. I think to a large extent, this is the promise that constitutes the Republican majority, right? They were elected and they ran on repeal of Obamacare. And that's what the voters in many cases sent them to Washington to do. So I think this is too big of a promise for them to walk away from. I think it would have huge implications, not only for the credibility of the rest of their agenda, but also politically for the 2018 midterms. I mean, voters are not going to send their representatives back to Washington if they haven't done what they said they would do. So I think the signs are positive that they're going to turn around and try to address this again.
Tim Jost, you've called on Democrats to help the president fix Obamacare in the meantime, notwithstanding this latest meeting among Republicans in the House about going back to the drawing table. But why should Democrats help the president fix Obamacare?
Well, I think one thing that needs to be understood is that the American Health Care Act was not primarily about health care reform. It was about a massive tax cut for rich Americans and health insurers and providers, and massive cuts in the Medicaid program, which takes care of poor people. And then it had a number of provisions addressing what most people think about as the Affordable Care Act, which is the individual market provisions. And let me just say, repeal of the Affordable Care Act is simply not possible. It's like repealing the interstate highway system. The bill only addressed maybe 5 to 10% of the Affordable Care Act, and most of the rest of it is so deeply interwoven into our healthcare system that it would not be possible to repeal it without pretty much ripping our healthcare system apart. But in any event, there were some good ideas in the American Health Care Act, providing subsidies to the states for stabilization of markets. Is one, providing tax credits for higher income Americans to help them purchase care in the individual market. And I think these are ideas that that Democrats could get behind. Avik Roy, who's a conservative commentator, has made some good proposals for merging means-tested tax credits for poor people with fixed dollar tax credits for higher income Americans. And so I think if the Republicans were open to actually trying to make the plan work rather than to destroy it, the individual market, I think there are some things that we could get some bipartisan support behind.
Rachel Bovard, is that ever an option for the folks at the Heritage Foundation to fix Obamacare?
Well, look, I think you just saw what happened when you tried to fix Obamacare. I mean, I don't think that there is the support on either side for that. The American Health Care Act tried to do that. It tried to fix Obamacare, repeal certain parts, replace others. I mean, it just did not work. I think there's too big of a consensus towards repeal. And I disagree that repeal is not possible. I mean, this bill, it has been in place for 7 years. I mean, it's not intrinsically woven into the healthcare system in such a way that it cannot be undone. This hasn't been in place. It hasn't even been in place for a decade yet. Well, I mean, these are reforms that can be made there.
Well, I mean, it would, if you repealed it, though, what are your estimates about how many people would find themselves uninsured the next day?
Well, I think let's be clear about what the repeal efforts have tried to do in the past. Most recently in 2015, when the House and Senate both passed a repeal bill that went to the president's desk, President mm-hmm. Obama then vetoed it. Mm-hmm. But within that bill was a 2-year phase out of Obamacare. So it wasn't like immediately afterward, the day after everyone was going to lose their care, it leveraged the political situation to say, look, we're going to repeal this, and then Congress has a 2-year deadline to come together with bipartisan reforms to fix the healthcare market. I mean, you have to give Congress a deadline, right, or they don't do anything. But, you know, that was the idea, and it was a politically strategic one, essentially, to say, look, Democrats, Obamacare is gone now. Let's come together, you know, propose bipartisan reforms that will fix this marketplace. You know, Obamacare isn't working. And the healthcare market before Obamacare wasn't working. So it's kind of coming back to the drawing board for both parties.
When you say it's not working, who isn't it working for? Because, you know, we hear from people all the time that, you know, we heard from a small business person earlier that says that it is working. He just wonders why, you know, the market can't be one market or the pools can't be one instead of two. Who's it not working for specifically?
Well, it's not working for the 1.7 million people who lost their health care coverage under Obamacare last year because prices have increased. You've seen premiums go up 140% on families, 99% for individuals. 70% of U.S. counties only have one or two options on the insurance exchanges now. I mean, this Affordable Care Act has become the wildly unaffordable Care Act. And so if our goal here is affordable costs, reduced prices on the insurance market, and accessible coverage, Obamacare is not meeting any of those metrics.
Tim Jost, what about that? You're saying you've said that enforcing the individual mandate is critical.
Yeah, I mean, the CBO looked at the American Health Care Act, and they said if that was adopted, 14 million people would lose coverage next year and 30 million by 2026. And that's consistent with their analysis of the attempt in 2015 to repeal the Affordable Care Act. I believe in Ohio, according to Kaiser Family Foundation, premiums actually dropped last year in the individual market, or at least in the marketplaces. The 140% figure is completely misleading. There were a couple. I think there was one state where premiums went up that much last year, The goal has to be, I mean, there are problems, obviously. There were problems before the Affordable Care Act was adopted. But I think what we saw was that I think only 17% of the population supported the American Health Care Act, and the Affordable Care Act is more popular now than ever. So I think that, again, what we need to do is see where there actually are problems and fix those, but not just tear the whole thing up root and branch. And I think this idea of let's repeal it, let's drive right up to the edge of the cliff and then see if we can figure out what to do is frankly pretty stupid. I mean, why would we do that? What we need to do, if the Republicans have any good ideas for fixing it, and I suggested there might be some there, let's work with those. But let's try to come up with what we're going to do next before we repeal, rather than try to blow the whole thing up first and then see if we can pull the pieces back together in some way.
Rachel Bovard, this often comes down to the philosophical question of do people deserve to have health care coverage? And I'm wondering, where does the Heritage Foundation stand on that particular issue? Has the Heritage Foundation always opposed this effort to provide insurance to most, if not all, Americans somehow?
No, I mean, I think the Heritage Foundation wants everyone to have access to affordable care. I mean, I think the primary goal driving this effort is to get most Americans or all Americans access to affordable care. I think where we've differed with Democrats and with, you know, different, policy ideas is the means in which we do that. We think that affordable care can be accessed better and delivered better when the private market has the ability to participate. You know, the government, the top-down approach hasn't worked, and frankly, to say a lot of this hinges on enforcement of individual mandate is laughable because it hasn't worked. I mean, you've seen that individuals, the people that you needed to buy into the market for this to work, young people, 35 and under, healthy young people, simply chose to pay the penalty in many cases rather than purchase care. And you saw this again with the CBO score when it was mentioned that 14 million people would lose care by lose coverage by 2018. What's not referenced about that statistic is that CBO also found most of those people would do it by choice. Again, sort of speaking to the fact that when you take the gun away from people's heads, they don't want to purchase care that, one, is very expensive, and two, a lot of times doesn't represent what they need. They want to buy care, but they don't want to have to pay inflated prices to pay for maternity care if they're a single man, or pediatric coverage, or, you know, all these things that Obamacare forces them to buy. So I think we all want to see affordable, accessible care. It's just we differ on the means for how that should be delivered.
Well, I guess you also differ on what care involves. I mean, if you're a man who was given, you know, doesn't everybody kind of depend on the fact that there's maternity care for women?
If you're a woman, sure, but should a single 20-year-old dude who's not married be forced to purchase the care with maternity coverage?
Well,
I mean, it's about...
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about that, and one proposal is that if men don't want to pay for, 20-year-old men don't want to pay for maternity coverage, let them all have the vasectomy so that we don't have to, we can know that they're never going to be responsible for anybody needing maternity coverage.
I mean, that is an issue. Well, of course, it's absurd. I mean, but Rachel Bovard, I mean, how does the system ever work? This is just a basic economics. How does the system ever work if we don't all pay in to help each other?
Look, I think that's what Obamacare tried to do, and it didn't work. What we do know works is allowing the states to regulate in this manner. If states want to provide this, if states want to say, look, and if you live, you know, in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. you are going to, you know, we're going to provide this essential health benefit. You know, all of you have to pay for maternity coverage. That's the state's choice. But okay. allow people choice in the marketplace and they will purchase coverage. Take that choice away and they'll opt out. So you're going to get a bigger risk pool the more you allow people to choose the coverage that they want.
How do you define choice? Because I don't have choice right now. I get my coverage through where I work and I'm lucky that way, but I don't get to choose.
Right. And that's actually one of the things that we've said that should be reformed in the individual market. You know, Heritage has long sought a policy that treats the individual market and the employer market in the same way. So it stops advantaging, you know, employer-sponsored care and gives those benefits to individuals. But, yeah, you should be allowed to choose.
Well, wouldn't that disadvantage individual care, though, if everybody started to go out and pick out their own? I mean, isn't the advantage of employer-sponsored intrinsic in the fact that they can, the more people they have in their pool, the better advantage they get? Again, it's that basic economic principle.
Well, I mean, that's the insurance company that's been benefiting from that necessarily, not the employer. The more people the insurance company covers, sure, the lower cost they can offer. But at the end of the day, you need to allow individuals the access to the same tax treatment that employers get that incentivizes that coverage. For individuals, they don't get that same big tax deduction mm-hmm. when they go out and purchase care, and they should be allowed that. And, you know, allowing that equality of tax treatment will allow the individual market to be a little bit more robust. More people will be able to afford it, thus increasing the risk pool and reducing costs for everyone.
Tim Jost?
Well, I think it is important for people to realize that the employer market is heavily subsidized by the federal government. And so providing tax subsidies for the individual market only makes things fairer. It doesn't in some way privilege the individual market. The CBO is projected.
Which is what we've been arguing. We said equality of treatment.
Excuse me?
Well, we're arguing for equality of treatment, not privileging one of the over the other.
Yes, I understand that, but I think that means that we do have to provide tax credits for people in the individual market. Tax deductions are pretty much useless for many people in the individual market because a deduction only helps you if you have income mm-hmm. on which you're paying taxes, and it helps you more the higher the tax bracket that you're in, the higher income you have. So deductions help out people who are wealthy, but they're useless to people with low incomes, who are the people that are being helped by the tax credits in the individual market. And as I suggested earlier, I think what would be ideal would be to have means-tested tax credits for people at the low-income levels like we do now, supplemented by cost-sharing reduction payments like we have now, but then provide fixed-dollar tax credits for people higher up the income scale so that they can afford health care as well. But tax deductions is clearly the wrong answer here. It's just the wrong vehicle.
That is all the time we have. Timothy Jost, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Timothy Jost, healthcare expert and emeritus professor at the Washington and Lee University School of Law. Also, Rachel Bovard, director of policy services for the Heritage Foundation. Rachel, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That is the end of the show today, but it is not at the end of the conversation. Fear not. We will continue to pursue this question and all of these questions. Thanks today for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.